paper three. Exposures at default. Bernadette.
This is my last paper, so after this, you won't hear from me again. Right, okay, so agenda paper three, and this addresses an issue relating to how an entity should estimate future drawdowns in respect of the undrawn element of revolving credit facilities. And so the submitter observes that in practice, the contractual credit limit on revolving credit facilities, such as credit cards and more commonly bank overdrafts, is often exceeded when the customer reaches a default. And the submitter notes that paragraph 5520 of IFRS 9 already sets out an exception for certain types of revolving credit facilities regarding the extension of the appropriate period to consider when measuring expected credit losses, but that there is no such specific exception regarding extending the contractual credit limit to an amount in excess of that limit. And so the submitter also observes that in respect of the undrawn element of these facilities, an entity is required to estimate the expected usage in order to determine the appropriate exposure at default, and that paragraph B5531 of IFRS 9 requires that this estimate be consistent with its expectations of drawdowns on that loan commitment. And the submitter notes in particular that this guidance does not explicitly stipulate whether an entity should only consider estimates within the contractual credit limits, and therefore asks whether an exposure in excess of that limit should be used when estimating the appropriate exposure at default, where an entity has a history of allowing customers to exceed their contractually set credit limits. And so in considering this question, we firstly would refer back to the definition of credit losses in IFRS 9, and that being the difference between all contractual cash flows that are due to the entity in accordance with the contract and all the cash flows that the entity expects to receive. And in the case of undrawn loan commitments, we note that the application guidance set out in paragraph B5530-31 of IFRS 9, which applies equally to a standalone loan commitment as it would the undrawn element of a revolving credit facility, requires an entity to estimate the usage of the undrawn facility in order to determine those contractual cash flows that would be due to it if the loan is drawn down. And furthermore, it clarifies the appropriate period over which those estimations should be made. And so while we noted that paragraph B5531 does not specifically refer to the contractual terms, it does form part of the application guidance supporting the definition of credit losses, which does refer to the contractual cash flows due to an entity, as does the preceding paragraph in B5530. And therefore, B5531 should be read in this context, and estimations of drawdowns should be made in accordance with the contractual terms, unless a more specific piece of guidance exists to the contrary. And then turning to the exception that's outlined in paragraph 5520, we note that this relates to the contractual commitment period and doesn't address the contractual credit limit. And we also observe that this is consistent with the discussions and the basis of conclusions, as respondents did not raise any specific concerns regarding amounts in excess of the credit limit. It was focusing more on the period over which expected credit losses should be measured. And consequently, it would not be appropriate to analogise this very specific exception to the contractual credit limit. And so that's agenda paper three. And so again, I'll hand it over to you for discussion.
Thank you, Bernadette. I think I'm going to sort of start talking about this a little bit in terms of from credit risk management practices, how do people sort of approach these types of products. For credit risk management purposes, one of the things that is done is operationally you have floor limits or pad limits which are over and above the notified customer limits, which firms will allow drawdown to be exercised against. When they're assessing the exposure at default, that will be reflected in terms of their measurement. As you've said, Bernadette, the narrow scope exemption was, quite specific relating to the tenor, but when you're looking at credit card products, the exposure at default inextricably links both the tenor and the amount. And although you note that no specific exception was raised, I think that's because the way people manage these types of exposures is very much with a clear understanding that such increases will actually be part of, will not be a deviation from the sort of contractual terms, but will be agreed modification. And we spoke at the last ITG about credit cards and how you have the same instrument, but you adjust the exposure at default as time goes on, either up or down. So I think what I would say is that operationally, it would not make sense to limit the exposure at default to just the contractual limit, which is notified to the customer, if that's the sort of proxy amount that you would use. I think I'm very mindful of the conference yesterday where we heard from the regulators that one of the things that a high quality implementation would need to consider is where the assessment of impairment allowance is less than the actual outturn that you would expect from that portfolio where you've significantly where you've had significant deterioration or otherwise, and I think this would if taken in the way that you've described, would lead to a disconnect between the accounting treatment and the regulatory treatment, which would be quite significant, I think, for the revolving product facilities.
And what do you think the words in IFRS 9 say?
I think what Bernadette has said in the paper is, I think what the words in IFRS 9 say are what the staff have said in the paper. But I just sort of draw attention to the fact that I think that's probably because we didn't make it explicit in the discussions, that when you're talking about behavioural life for credit cards, you are talking about both the tenor and the amount.
John?
Thanks, Bill. My understanding of how this works is very similar to Bill's. I agree with the staff analysis. You take into account contractual terms, and there's one exception to that, and that's for revolving credit facilities, which have a non-drawn and drawn facility. And there you have an exception that you can look out past the contractual term in certain circumstances. And therefore, I agree with where the staff have landed in terms of this, that you must look at the contractual terms when you're talking about amounts. And I think the words in the standard are clear. But in saying that, I'd make two observations, and I suppose this is my but. The first is I would agree with Bill. When banks look and talk about the behavioural aspects of revolving credit facilities, they talk about tenor and amount as inextricably linked, and there may have been a disconnect in terms of the analysis when people were submitting comments through the exposure process. I think if we look at the substantive part of the behavioural aspects of revolving credit facility, and if you look at tenor without looking at amount, you're only getting half the issue, or you're only getting half the answer, if you like. In contractual terms, a bank can stop a credit card at any point in time, but they don't. They let it run in terms of time, and they also let it run in terms of amount. And the ceiling on the amount isn't the amount that's written in the terms of the piece of paper the customer signed. The ceiling on the amount is what they call, I think Bill, is the floor limit, and that's what they're running against. And I think that's one thing that needs to be taken into account when you're looking at kind of the behavioural aspects rather than behavioural time, and I agree that's slightly different. The second point is what's really meant by contractual. The substance of this type of facility is the customer comes in and signs a written contract. The written contract has a limit on it, that's clear, but also custom and practice then happens thereafter where the bank are actually advancing money over and above the limit. So the bank are operating as if there is a contractual limit, which is something different than the piece of paper. And one could argue in certain customer situations, maybe a lot of customer situations, couldn't say all, but that the customer is operating on the basis that they have a limit which is somewhere above the actual written down limit. And that's the way they operate on a monthly basis, on a yearly basis in terms of their interactions with the banks. And secondly, when excess funds are then drawn down, we would argue that when we look at those, we'd argue that they should be viewed as one unit of account, one contract, but yet we're saying that the excess funds are not part of the contractual arrangement. And to argue that the excess amount isn't part of the, in substance, what the contractual arrangements are, may be seen that they're actually two separate units of account. So I think, without getting into the legal intricacies of what is or isn't a contract, because that's a complete minefield and it depends on what jurisdiction you're in, I think kind of in substance to me, they feel very much like the same thing. Now, I think I would agree, Sue, the words say one thing, but I'm just not sure they're getting really to the substance of the point here.
Martin?
I think for me the standard is very clear, and if we look at this case, man, I think really what is communicated and to the customer, what is the limit, that is a contractual amount and not really what the bank has maybe internally accept or not accept. And for me that is a contractual amount here, and therefore I think really this case here, I think what also the staff prepared is very clear, okay, that we should not extend it. We have done an exception, but that was limited and that was not to the amount, and therefore I think the answer to that is clear. And that is really what is externally to the customer communicated, and that what is the limit, that is amount where we should calculate that.
Before I call on others, I think I completely understand the economic cases that you're making, and I also understand the point that John raised about the how integrated the sort of these amounts are and how artificial it might be to separate them. And that's similar to the discussion that we had on the revolving facilities and the drawn, undrawn, which caused us to make some changes in the way we thought about things, and similar to the thinking that caused us to make a specific exception to the life of revolving facilities, which has turned out to be so easy to apply. But let's not forget that even before we published the final document, our exposure draft was even more strict. It's very important to us that we look at contractual boundaries and legal obligations. So if everybody who's got their cards up are going to plead further about the economic case, can I please ask you maybe not to pile on too much, because our role here is really to read the words. And I hear what you say from an economic perspective, but we've got a published standard, and I think it was a clear decision by the board. It's unfortunate in retrospect that we didn't have a more specific articulation of this associated issue with the maturity of the facilities, but I think we're sort of where we are. With that plea, Graham?
Thanks, Sue. I hearken back to our last meeting where we talked about the issue of the Swiss mortgages, right, that were, in theory, and per contract, callable pretty much at any point, although they had an expected life much longer than that. And one of the discussion items, one of the things we discussed here was whether or not that call was really a substantive part of the contract. If the borrower was current, we thought in a lot of jurisdictions they wouldn't even be legally allowed to utilize that call. And again, I don't want to play lawyer here, I'm certainly not one, but I wonder if that same discussion isn't something that should inform our thinking on this issue as well. And if it's not, I think it would be helpful to understand why. Because that wasn't abundantly clear to me, because I saw them as fairly parallel circumstances, that you might look at the legal and regulatory environment in which you operated, and if you'd established a practice of doing something and that became sort of a legally binding thing, whether or not it was documented, it would still be substantively part of the contract. And so I just think it might be helpful to have some discussion somewhere around that thinking.
I think the slight difference between those two, just off the top of my head and trying to remember back to April, was that in that case we had a situation where the contract did envisage a longer life, but there were rights to terminate the longer life. So the contract did talk about a longer term and a potential shorter term. So you had two things in a contract. Here we're talking about a contract with an X amount of limit, and we're talking about whether you can then compute something over and above what's written down, which is think is slightly different low.
I think also, man, if we would allow that, I think we have to discuss it also for other products. Man, why we would allow that for a certain kind of product and not for others? Man, for loans to big customers, maybe the bank is also maybe has internal limit and say, okay, I would be prepared also to give them credit of double what they have externally communicated to them. And that's the question, if we allow it in these circumstances, where do we stop? And I think there's one principle in accounting is, okay, maybe we do it based on contractual terms and not on other things.
So I agree with the staff analysis and I accept the contractual idea. I understand dealing with our credit modeling people that they really don't like this outcome because they believe they're not modeling the ultimate loss that the entity is going to incur. But I think when the bank decides to extend beyond the contractual term, that's a future decision. It's an option they have. They don't necessarily have to do it. But then what we've had is feedback is, okay, but you know, where it's stipulated in the contract what the limit is, that's straightforward and easy. But I went and took my own checking account and looked through the loan agreement, and lo and behold, there is no overdraft limit specified. There's clearly an overdraft fee, and the bank makes it clear if you do it, we're going to charge you this X fee plus a very handsome interest rate. But it didn't stipulate what it is. So the amount of the overdraft is entirely at the discretion of the bank. And so the modelers come back and say, so what should I do? Make it zero? Or should I go looking inside the bank, which only they know? Operationally, I set the limit at $1,000. And I'm going to use it because that's the bank's initial view of the contract. But the client, me, I know nothing about what the limit is. And so then is it zero? And I think what I'd prefer the answer to be is the bank has said from its perspective it's $1,000 because that's what's programmed into the system, under which they would honor anything. A check that I gave that where there were insufficient funds, they would go up to $1,000 without any further action on their part. So I put that out there because this issue of what is contractual isn't as simple. Many charge cards apparently are also the same way. And unless we go digging into the contracts, we're never going to find out exactly what this is. And the modeling people do have to have an answer to make this work.
Chris?
Yeah, I'm not going to talk about the economics, but I'm going to talk about, I guess, similar points to John and George as to what the contract says. And yeah, I agree the standard says look at the contract and expected losses would be based on analysis of contractual cash flows and shortfalls. If you exceed your limit on a borrowing facility, I would imagine that that excess borrowing is still under the terms of the contract, and the bank can sue you to the repayment under the terms of the contract. Now, as for the argument around the exemption, well, I'm not sure one needs to look for sort of exemption, special exemption here, because the guidance that's quoted talks about what are the expectations of cash shortfalls versus contractual cash flows, and if these drawings could happen under the contract, then they could fall within that definition of expected credit losses. But I think there's a contradiction or incoherence about sort of taking this notion of a contractual limit and sort of applying that into the exemption as a hard number, because if we talk about the exemption, it's about facilities that can be withdrawn at any time. So if I give somebody a limit of £1,000 to lay on some overdraft, and I say I've got some behavioural model that says those exposures will go out 2 years, well, what is there in the standard that says put £1,000 in to that model going forward? Because I can withdraw the £1,000 limit tomorrow. So why is the £1,000 set in stone? If you're going to be consistent about only looking at the contractual limit, well, the contractual limit tomorrow, it could be zero because there's no commitment to keep that limit in place. The other thing is, a bit like George says, when you look at many agreements, they just talk about, the bank can choose to set, reinforcing the same point, the bank can choose what the limit is. It can choose what to advance. Our checking account agreements in the UK will have terms that deal with unauthorised overdrafts. The contract specifically addresses borrowing in excess of advised limits. So I just don't buy the idea this is all outside the terms of the contract.
but I think the other thing apart from the link to contractual that was very much forefront of the board's mind when they were thinking about how to scope this, because we don't forget that we did have discussions specifically initially about being completely constrained by the legal commitment. So legal term, you know, I can cancel my credit cards overnight, so the outlook period's 1 day. Consistent with that would be strictly what's the legally committed amount, so it wouldn't necessarily include George's overdraft facility, because the bank might decide they don't like George and not let him have his overdraft. I'm sure they won't, but and we had a specific discussion then to expand that in one very specific case. But I think otherwise the idea of what you're legally committed to is the core foundation of all of this. So maybe it's not even so much what does the contract say, it's what is my legally committed exposure to this customer, and I think that's at the heart of it.
I was just going to support my colleagues, and I think the point that you raised, it's all around what is determined as a contractual limit. I don't think in contracts, as George has indicated, it is as clear as there is a contractual limit. I think it is done in such a way that amounts in excess of whatever is the agreed limit are allowed. As you said, the undrawn overdraft fee, a very good example of that. And the other example I wanted to point out, if you look at the standard definition for what constitutes default for an overdraft facility, it's one where you're in excess of your limit amount for 90 days plus. So that's the standard definition. It's one that the regulators use as a standard definition. It's the whole concept of being in excess of a deemed limit is one that is standard. And I think they're very carefully worded in the way the banks put their terms and contracts together.
Trying to stick to the wording of IFRS 9 and adding to what Chris said, there's an alternative to viewing this from the perspective of the exposure at default, and that is to view it in terms of the cash shortfalls. So IFRS 9 says that whenever there's historical information, that historical information should be used as an anchor or starting point to base the estimation. So if we take this on board, you would have historical effective drawdowns that would be compared with the cash flows that were actually received in that historical period. So that would base the historical cash shortfall on which the estimation would be based. In that sense, I would say that irrespective of what the contract is saying, the effective cash shortfalls that were evidenced in a historical period would take on board the excess drawdowns that were in fact in place by borrowers. That I would say that's the carrot. Now comes the stick. From the perspective of prudent underwriting, I mean, this kind of practice, this kind of acceptance of the excess drawdowns would not only affect the exposure at default. I would say, in terms of the estimation of the expected credit loss, it would also affect probabilities of default and the exposure at default. Because if there's a current and common practice to extend or accept the overdrafts, the excess drawdowns on the pre-agreed limits, whether those limits are implicit or explicit, if that practice is accepted, I would say that would attract the lowest credit quality borrowers. So that would in fact affect also the probability and of default and the exposure and the loss given default. So I think these considerations should be taken on board as well.
I just wanted to come in, and I understand where this is coming from. I understand exactly where we look at the past behavior to determine EAD, but as Martin pointed out, there was a very clear requirement in the standard that we work to the contractual terms, because otherwise I think we are changing over one of the most basic proponents which our board considered and didn't go to the full behavioral route, was to look at the contractual cash flows. And if I look at the history of the development, the exemption was brought in was very specific and very limited. So now if what we are trying to do is extend that beyond that, and where do we draw the line? And also what is meant by the contractual terms is a very big question. It not only affects this, it affects everything else. It means I know of what, from IS 32 to other things. So I think if I look at the standard, the way it is written and the intent, I don't think the intent was ever to extend this to full behavioral for the contractual. That's why the words are used for the contractual cash flows. And to come and say that we can make an exception, the question is, the exception that the board intended to make is already in the standard. How far do we extend it, if at all? That's the concern that we have.
Well, that would require a change to the standard,
yep.
And I don't think that's what we hear from. But George.
So the other example that I thought of afterwards is the example of a charge card where it stipulated there is no limit. And I have to be honest, I think most of the time that no limit concept is more of a marketing ploy to make sure that you never run out of room when you're traveling and so on. And they're probably given to very, very good credit risk individuals to begin with. But in the contract, they would not stipulate an amount. But internally, they would set, I think sometimes they call them speed bumps, at certain points where they would then say, okay, maybe we should slow this person down. So the contractual amount, in theory, is unlimited.
Yeah, but in that case, you're just going to look at the expected drawdown, so it's not like we're saying assume infinite.
But then, so I guess what I'm really asking is this concept of the internal speed bumps, if that is all that's left to look at, would you think that's a reasonable way of starting the discussion? Because nothing else is specified. That's what I think I would really like to know. And if others have views on that, I think it would be useful.
I think it's best not to answer that on the fly. We can come back, but I prefer, we always end in tears when we do analysis of issues on the fly. We can bring it back if people want to, but I'd prefer not to do it off the cuff, if that's right. John?
I do think just thinking about your comment on legally committed amounts and thinking about maybe read acrosses to other scenarios, and I'm really just focused in on this. The minute you kind of extend from the contractual time period to a behavioral, for want of a better word, time period, you have to look at what you're going to draw down over that behavioral time period. And amount and tenor are inextricably linked, because actually at a point in time, if I've got a zero credit, a zero balance, you can stop tomorrow. So if you stop tomorrow, that's it. If I've got a balance of 10 grand on my card, but I expect it's going to run for 4 years, and in 2 years, in a month's time, my limit's going to be upped by 20, what do I look at? So the minute you start to extend tenor, you do have to consider the implications that would have on the legally committed amount over that period. I think that's where it kind of gets tricky.
Yeah.
I think that's where it's difficult. And I just wonder whether you're getting the right, right is a bad word, but we're getting an appropriate answer by being stuck with what's written on a piece of paper. Because what actually is written is, I don't have to extend time, and I can close the card at this point in time. And that closes it in terms of amount and in terms of time. The minute I extend time, then do I not, there is automatically the consideration as to what happens with an extension or what happens to the legally committed amount over that time period. I think that's where people are struggling.
And I absolutely agree with you, because I think as soon as we extended the time period, it does then draw into question what does that then imply for amount. But I think people are agreeing with me, generally, that the standard says at the moment, you do have to look at future drawdowns, that's clear, but I think we're saying that's capped at the contractually committed amount. Could be less, could be up to that amount, but not more. For us to then say in this room it's a fantastic idea to have a different approach, that's a whole different discussion. That's a whole discussion that needs the board deliberation. That's not something we can all decide is a great idea and let's put it in the minutes of this group as a fantastic idea that's better than what we wrote before. So I think the best thing we can do from this discussion is to confirm that the exception was about term, not about amount, and to flag the fact that you've all raised the point that that doesn't necessarily gel with how, from a credit risk perspective, you would think about expected losses on those exposures, and we can flag that to the board. But I don't think that we're doing anyone any favours suggesting that there'd be any bigger consequence from this discussion today.
I think that's very fair.